This is Reyes López Tijerina, and you are listening to Radio Aztlán, KUCR 88.3. Que viva la raza.
Welcome to a 2-hour special on Reyes López Tijerina. Your host tonight is Roberto Betoman Tijerina and
Anthony Huaracha.
And we're going to be presenting many interviews, corridos, and information on a legendary hero, legend, and icon of El Chicano Movimiento.
The late Reyes López Tijerina, yes, he was a key figure in the civil rights movement era, going all the way from the late 50s all the way into his death, a real significant fighter for justice.
So tonight you'll be hearing from Dr. Armando Navarro.
Dr. Jose Angel Gutierrez.
Also one of the four Chicano horsemen. Dr. Enrique Murillo.
Dr. Luis Ignacio Quiñones.
Arturo Bones Rodriguez of Crusade for Justice. The chairman of the National Brown Berets de Aztlán, David Rico. And
Reyes López Tijerina's wife, Esperanza Tijerina.
We want to thank everyone for their participation in this 2-hour special of the legendary hero, Reyes López Tijerina. Welcome, Dr. Armando Navarro, who is a professor here at the Ethnic Studies Department at UC Riverside, a specialist in political science, ¿verdad?
Yes.
Now, you've written several books, Armando. What do you have to say about Reyes López Tijerina?
Well, I think that as we were talking about previously to this interview, as a scholar and also an activist, you have to remember that I go back to the days of the Chicano movement. I was an activist starting in 1968, and I haven't stopped. So I'm one of the few what I would categorize as organic intellectuals in our Chicano community that has maintained a commitment to activism and scholarship. And that's why the production of 7 books, and my latest book is The Mexicano Latino Politics and the Quest for Self-Determination, which was just released. Even in that new book, the contributions of Tijerina are acknowledged and respected because when you look at the whole gamut of the history of our experience, our political experience, in particular during the Chicano movement, this man was a great architect of the Chicano movement. He was one of the leading four horsemen, as Mayer and Rivera in their book Chicanos categorized Tijerina as one of the major four leaders of the Chicano movement. And I would argue that it's a toss-up between Cesar Chavez and Reyes López Tijerina as to who was a more catalytic stimulus, if that's not redundant a little bit, to say as a personality, because both in the context of Chicano history, in the context of 1966 to 1968, were concurrently emerging. Chavez with the incredible movement towards organizing the United Farm Worker here in California by 1966 with his March on Sacramento. And at the same time in 1966, you have the rise of Reyes López Tijerina, the rise of the Alianza Federal de Mercedes as an organization that was founded by Reyes in 1963, doing the same thing, organizing a march to Santa Fe, which is the capital of Nuevo Mexico. And so different strategies, perhaps very similar in content, but outcomes very different because the issues that drove Tijerina were different from those of Chavez. Chavez was farm worker looking at the whole issue of improving the quality of life, the working conditions, the unionization of the farm worker and so forth. And Reyes López Tijerina was dealing with what is something that no one else dealt with, and that is the issue of land grants and so forth. That was his primary drive in terms of purpose for the Alianza and him as a leader. So different agendas, but yet Reyes, by the time we hit the period of 1966, after that so-called incredible march from Albuquerque to Santa Fe, followed the occupation of the Kit Carson Echo and Fight Theater. And this was in late September, October that occurred. And this was the first militant act by a leader, because he had the audacity to use symbolically the tactic of projecting the imagery that they're reoccupying land that was theirs, because it was part of a land grant and so forth. And he was bold enough to make a promulgation that that land was theirs, and it was theirs to declare a republic. He declared in symbolic terms a republic, the Rio de Chama and so forth. And they had an ayuntamiento, a council, they organized a militia and so forth. And that led ultimately to a second occupation, which led to the arrest of two park rangers and so forth. But that event crystallized the new militancy of not only Reyes López Tijerina, but the new militancy of the Chicano movement. And this is where you think, you know, who was a greater contributor to the incredible protest and militancy that permeated much of the Chicano movement by 1969? Well, I would say at that point, Tijerina was far ahead of the curve, because what followed after the occupation of that Echo Infi Theater was the Tierra Maria courthouse raid in 1967. And that was an issue that was precipitated by the actions of a district attorney, Alfonso Sanchez, that intervened in trying to halt meetings that the Alianza was holding in that part of Nuevo Mexico, the northern part. And so essentially, as a retaliation to the actions by the district attorney, they raided the courthouse and in the process created an almost international controversial situation that wound up with two people being wounded in the action, two being held hostage. What followed was a mobilization of the Nuevo Mexico National Guard. I can remember that the newspapers at the time depicted the situation like it was a Vietnam occurring in Aztlan, the southwest, specifically Nuevo Mexico. And that was a major militant action for Mexicanos, armed Mexicanos, 20 of them from the Alianza, to go into a police situation where they had to confront them and take the prisoners and take hostages and actually use weapons, all right? That was unprecedented. And so that precipitated an incredible media outburst describing Tijerina as an agent of Cuba trained by Fidel Castro and so forth. Senator Joseph Montoya at the time was categorizing him as a danger to the security of this country and so forth. So that added to the incredible impetus of his image as a leader. In 1968, Reyes López Tijerina was invited by Martin Luther King before he was assassinated to participate in the Poor People's March. Unfortunately, Martin Luther King was assassinated, and Reverend Abernathy continued with the struggle to hold Poor People's March on Washington, and he was invited as one of the major Chicano leaders, as well as Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez from Denver, Colorado. So you had two major leaders now acknowledged at a national scale, and Tijerina very wisely used the weeks and months of occupation of that small parcel of land on Washington, D.C., to do the lobbying, to do the advocacy on behalf of his issue, which was the land grants. He met with Secretary of State Dean Rusk. He met with other government officials. He had a protest of the Supreme Court. This man was truly courageous. So it's not just a visionary of using, knowing how to use the media and the power behind the masses, because you have to remember by this time, the Alianza as an organization had over 10,000 members, and perhaps it was the largest organization in the southwest of Mexicanos, all right? This was poor people, was very grassroots oriented. So by 1968, he truly becomes recognized by the national media. He becomes an incredible emerging leader of the Chicano movement, and he is very much sought by students, in particular those of UMAS in 1967-68. I mean, I can remember my first encounter with Reyes López Tijerina was here at UCR in 1969. When I was a student at Claremont Men's College, I came here to UCR, and he gave a speech. There were hundreds of people here right in front of the library. I can remember that. And I had never heard or never seen such a man deliver such a powerful speech. I mean, he was an evangelical minister. He knew how to use his voice, how to project, how to use symbolism, how to combine the symbolism of religion with that of the politics that he was projecting in terms of the land grants and so forth. So I was super impressed. And I went home more excited than ever. I was just a young activist. I started organizing in 68. And with the appearance of Tijerina, it gave me impetus, gave me extra energy, so to speak, to continue.
The following is an excerpt from the four-part series, Chicano, Quest for Homeland.
October 1966, a group of Mexican-Americans gathered to remind the United States of a long-forgotten promise. Calling themselves the Alianza, the Alliance, they met and claimed this federal land as their own, guaranteed by a treaty signed between the United States and Mexico. They arrested two United States forest rangers for trespassing.
We're taking full responsibility. The town of San Joaquin is just a second. Yes, I know your laws already. We've been citizens of the United States for 120 years and we know the law. We're taking this upon our shoulders in the name of the town of San Joaquin del Rio de Chama.
Ultimately, it was the leader of the Alianza who was arrested, Reyes López Tijerina. But he planned to use that trial to argue that, according to a treaty signed by the United States, the people of northern New Mexico legitimately owned the land. At one time, the land in New Mexico, along with California, Nevada, Arizona, Utah, Texas, and parts of Colorado and Wyoming, belonged to Mexico. In 1846, the United States declared war on Mexico. 2 years later, the war was over, and Mexico had lost half its territory. Overnight, 100,000 Mexicans became foreigners on soil that had belonged to their families for generations. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo promised these new Americans free enjoyment of their liberty and property of every kind.
The land was sacred because your parents and grandparents
were buried there.
Some of your children were buried there. And you would be buried there. So the sweat, blood, and tears of generations have filtered into the land. So it is holy, it is sacred. Sacrosanct.
But the original land grants had been given under Spanish and Mexican law, which U.S. courts often did not recognize. Over the years, Mexican Americans lost their land to speculators, lawyers, and cattle barons. Some property was taken by force.
And the heirs to those land grants have resented that ever since. The Tierra Maria land grant was an immense land grant given to a certain Martinez from Los Ojos, New Mexico. And I understand that the land grant was sold for $200, a team of horses, and I don't know how many pounds of flour or something like that. But only one of the heirs signed the deed. The other heirs didn't. So the land grant was taken illegally.
By 1960, millions of acres, including the Tierra Amarilla grant, had been taken from the original landowning families. Stepping into this long simmering land dispute was Reyes López Tijerina. Born in Texas during the 1920s, he was the son of migrant workers. After a prophetic dream about injustice in New Mexico, Tejerina decided to learn treaty law. He was convinced that he could reclaim the Tierra Amarilla grant.
Although we are fighting for land, we are fighting for the survival and protection of our culture. To the extent that we feel that to rape the culture and the
land. Some who disagreed with Tejerina thought he was an opportunist looking for personal power.
That's just the way we will fight.
What you're really saying, in effect, is that you own this land, you want everybody else to get off of it, or if they want to stay on it, to submit to your regulations.
No, to the regulations of the town councils, which are covered and protected by the Constitution of New Mexico, Article 2, Section 5, and by the Constitution of the United States, Article 12, Section 2, where it states that all the treaties made by the United States government are the supreme law of the land.
The people of northern New Mexico lived as tenants on land that once was theirs. In 1965, the Forest Service revoked half the grazing permits for small farmers, pushing them to the point of desperation. There was need for someone who could express their frustrations. When Tejerina, a former fundamentalist preacher, came along, he sounded like the Messiah himself.
We are now waiting an answer from the State Department to claim what belongs to us.
He was speaking the magic words. The issue, the struggle, had been alive for all these generations. And here was a man. A man on a white horse. A man with tremendous charisma who plugged in to a deep felt passion, more than a feeling, a passion. And he turned the spirits on.
I'm going to introduce now citizen number one of La Raza Nueva, Reyes López Tejerina.
Hay una perra, cuando pare perrito, la perra quiere a sus perritos, se muere por sus perritos. Pero si usted le trae un perrito chiquito de otra perra y lo junta con aquellos, se lo come la perra, lo mata porque no tiene nada para la otra perra. Si es una gallina con pollitos, los quiere, los protege y se pelea por sus pollos. Pero si le trae un pollo extranjero, mata al pollo extranjero. Una madre puede morir por sus hijos, los quiere y los ama. Y sufre y se desvela, pero si le dan un entrenado, no lo puede cuidar como a sus hijos que salieron del vientre de ella. Así tampoco nunca un gobierno extranjero ni una raza extranjera nunca podrá contra las leyes de la naturaleza tratarnos con igualdad a los entrenados como a los hijos.
Reflexiones del pasado, KUCR 88.3 FM.
Evil Raza by Agustin Lira.
Thank you.
You're listening to KUCR 88.3 FM Radio Aslan in Riverside.
Welcome. Today we have Professor Enrique Murillo at Cal State San Bernardino, and also, Enrique, are you there?
I am. Yes, the executive director of LEAD, which is Latino Education and Advocacy Days, and also the president of the Hispanic Serving Consortium of Southern California.
All right, that's a mouthful, carnal. How are you doing today?
Okay, lead then.
Now, we're here to discuss a little bit about Reyes López Tijerina. You had brought him to your conference a couple of years ago. You met the man, and you've also read about him in Chicano Studies. What can you tell me?
Yeah, you know, I'm very saddened to hear he's very well known as a pioneer and, like I said, a warrior in the early social movements here in the United States. But then he kind of fell into obscurity. Nobody had heard from him for a lot of years until finally a good friend of ours, Armando Cepeda, did some research, and he located him down in El Paso. And unfortunately, he was just to himself. He had gotten remarried, so he was there with his wife, Esperanza, and living in a small little, like a one-room apartment or house in El Paso, and kind of living out his golden years. And when we organized the 2012 LEAD Summit, Latino Education Advocacy Day Summit, here in Southern California, his name was brought to our attention by Armando Cepeda, because we had found him after searching for him for so many years. We found him, and we thought it was appropriate from our end to give him a platform so that a whole new generation of people, of Chicanos and non-Chicanos, could learn about the El Tigre, you know, this famous activist, Reyes López Tijerina, who is known mostly for founding the Alianza Federal de Pueblos Libres, in English, the Federal Alliance of Land Grants in New Mexico, which is a movement to reclaim the Spanish and Mexican land grants held by Mexicans and other Native Americans before the U.S.-Mexican War, which was, according to my understanding, something that, like, nearly 100 million acres. And, you know, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which is coming up the February 2nd, is the anniversary of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. It was signed after the U.S. Was, you know, victorious over Mexico. It guaranteed Mexican citizens the retention of their land grant. Of course, like other treaties made with Native peoples, the United States did not respect and broke that treaty, and so he founded the Alianza, which was hoping and struggled to reclaim ownership of that land through the courts in New Mexico. And so, however, it was determined in a court ruling later on that the United States Congress was the arbitrator on issues of land grants based on international treaties. And he had became famous when on June 1967, he led an armed raid at the Rio Arriba County Courthouse in Tierra Amarilla, New Mexico, and he had collaborated closely with the late Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. on the Poor People's Campaign, which is kind of derails the whole notion that he was just interested in just helping La Raza or just a small group of land grant inheritors in New Mexico, but he was looking at social movements across the board, across racial and ethnic lines. We learned so much from him. My understanding is he was the only one during that struggle for the land in New Mexico. He kept records of his work, and that was so instrumental in understanding the early workings of a social movement. How do you put a social movement together? How do you sustain a social movement? And so we brought him to the LEAD Summit at Cal State San Bernardino, March 2012. And he was in a wheelchair already. He had already had he was battling, I think, diabetes and other illnesses, other ailments. But with a respirator, he had an oxygen tank. Hey, he gave it full force. He got on the plane. He arrived here in Southern California, and he put on a tremendous performance, you could say, because really he was a performer. He was a great orator. He was known as being, as a preacher. You can tell he knew what he was talking about. He spoke. He spoke passionately, about his life and the struggles, and through firsthand knowledge. And when we were sitting there listening to him giving his talk at the LEAD Summit, it was like witnessing history all over again. He was speaking in first person terms.
When I came to my senses, I noticed that the Anglo told me, "You are now free. You are a free man in the land of the free." I like to compare that freedom to the freedom that a man gave to a bird that he had in a cage. He took this little bird and says, "I'm going to set you free. Free, no longer behind the bars." And he took the scissors and cut the two wings. "Now go, go." Well, naturally the bird could not fly, and naturally the blue-eyed cat came and ate the bird. So, that's my freedom, ladies and gentlemen, for me, to me, the language, which is the result of accumulated exercise of centuries. The language make out the two wings of a bird. With our language, we defend ourselves. The language is the primary element of our identity. And there are many crimes. But the greatest crimes of all is to rape the language of a culture, to tell a people not to speak his own language.
Información para nuestra liberación, KUCR 88.3 FM. Welcome. Today we have a speaker here, and we're speaking about Reyes López Tijerina. We have on our phone Mr. Dr. Luis Quiñones. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Buenas noches.
All right. Now, you met Mr. Tijerina, and you've been in his presence. You also wrote a corrido. What is the corrido called?
The corrido is called El Corrido de Reyes López Tijerina.
All right. And where can they find that? If people are looking for it,
you know what? I will be putting it on my web page, and that web page, drnachoq.wix.com/drnacho. So it's Dr. Nacho Q, www.wix.com/Dr. Nacho.
All right.
And I'll put it on the website here in the next couple of days, and you can find it, Corrido de Reyes López Tijerina.
All right. Now, what inspired you to write this corrido?
Well, I've known Reyes Tijerina since 1967, June 5th, the courthouse raid, the famous courthouse raid. But I did not meet him until 2009. Do you understand what I'm saying? I was a high school student, and he connected with all the raza. I was at Cobre High School in southwest New Mexico. The Tierra Amarilla courthouse raid happened in northern New Mexico. And we just connected. And there was a guy with guts, somebody that fought back. He put his life on the line. He was being pursued and persecuted by the National Guard, by the government, by cops, left and right. The poor little village of Tierra Amarilla with just a couple of thousand inhabitants was filled with tanks rolling through town and helicopters flying overhead, cops and National Guardsmen marching. Oh, it was chaos, and it's because somebody stood up for the Constitution. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo is the law in Nuevo Mexico and in the United States, and the Constitution, and he used the right of citizens' arrest because they prohibited the Alianza from lawful assembly. And so that's all he did. That's all he did. He was just following the Constitution. And, of course, that was a threat to the government. But that's when I finally met him in 2009. I had sought him out for many, many years and never connected until I got his phone number from Juan José Peña. He was the second president of the Raza Unida Party. And he gave me some leads, and I finally found him in El Paso, in a little apartment in El Paso, Texas.
And when you met him, what did you think about him?
Oh, it was like, I almost started crying when I saw him. He saw me, and after 2 minutes of talking, he tells me, "Hermano, yo sé quién es usted. Y usted y yo somos hermanos." He told me. He said, "You and I are brothers." He could tell right away that we connected. Is señor muy fuerte, man. He's strong, man. He almost broke my hand when he shook the hand. Even till the end, he's a very strong individual. Pero sí, muy buena gente, muy cariñoso. And you could tell, you know, he still had that passion. He had that fire in his eyes. And he sacrificed so much for us. Things changed for us in Nuevo Mexico. I was a sophomore in high school when this occurred. And I remember the professor saying, "Well, Reyes López Tijerina, he's just out for himself." I raised my hand, and another guy behind me also backed me up. And he said, "If he's for himself, why are they trying to kill him?" You know, so but this guy's for the people. So anyway, it was that kind of situation. Every time we would see the name Reyes López Tijerina in the newspapers, it was next to a story of the Vietnam War. Communists do this, communists do that. Everything was negative when they would put an article next to his, but we knew there was something good. We knew he was righteous, and he always was, man. But he was a intelligent and intellectual. He knew the Bible from the first page to the last. He could quote you specifically, not only the quotes and the information and the gist of it, everything. But the page number and the paragraph, hijo, la se aventaba el Reyes. So yeah, we became good friends. That was the main reason. He asked me, "Pues por qué vino a buscarme? Yo nomás quiero conocerlo. I just want to meet you porque usted hizo mucho por nosotros." After the courthouse raid, you won't believe this, but they did not want us to align ourselves as young people to Reyes López Tijerina. So they started throwing a few crumbs to us. We started getting some Mexican-American, Chicano, Chicana teachers in our public schools. We started getting a few Mexican-American Chicano studies courses here and there. We started getting some materials. And so it was interesting. I told him that he was saying, I paid the price. And I said, "Well, yeah, pero you advanced. It was progress. Your life has meant progress for our people."
Exactly. And that's what a lot of people don't realize is that we have to have leaders that are going to put their lives in front of la causa, ¿verdad?
That's correct. And even some of the land grants were litigated and cases reopened. And nowadays, you know, some of those land grants have, the heirs have recaptured some of that land that was stolen from them through, well, sometimes by force and, of course, sometimes by unsavory, unscrupulous, illegal acts by the government after the invasion of the United States of our territories of what we call Aztlan in started in 1846, and it took them a long time. We fought back the 1848 in Nuevo Mexico. The people in Taos were really resilient in resisting the invasion. But in any event, you know, the invaders came in, and the first thing they did was take away our land.
Exactly.
And, but anyway, because of Reyes Tijerina, some of the descendants and heirs have started winning cases.
Yes, exactly. And we're always going to remember Reyes López Tijerina. I want to thank you for calling in and participating with us. Is there any last comments?
Well, Roberto, I just want to say thank you, you know, for helping educate la gente and keeping la gente informed. Because, you know, as we say, la gente primero y la gente siempre. The people will eventually overcome and will win. So I just wanted to thank you. And, of course, all the people out there, a lot of you had heard about Reyes López Tijerina. And I know a lot of you that are listening marched with Reyes López Tijerina. I didn't have that blessing in my life. I marched with him toward the end of his life, marched with him in his, you know, in his company and his words. For those of you that were with him during the marches and the struggles, and I really commend you and I congratulate you. He's a great man.
All right, muchas gracias, eh?
Okay, Beto, man, muchas gracias. Y buenas tardes, buenas noches.
Buenas noches, adiós.
Adiós.
Reyes López Tijerina by los hermanos Baraja.
Reyes López Tijerina es un hombre muy famoso. En los Estados Unidos es un líder poderoso. Jefe de todos los indios y de todos los chicanos. Perseguido por los gringos, defensor de mexicanos. Tijerina con sus leales tomaron un municipio. Río arriba fue su meta, los pensó desde un principio. Lo metieron a la cárcel para ver si se rendía, abusaron de su casa. Hicieron mil cuatro bombas les fallaron, querían volar su piscina. A su coche lo tronaron el odio desde una esquina. Lo juzgaron en la corte declarándolo inocente. Ha ganado Tijerina, se portó como un valiente. Ese día sin 5 de junio del año 67. Es la fecha más gloriosa que celebra con su gente. Ya con esta me despido, camino por la frontera donde estuvo el gran chicano. El escrito lo pantera.
We have here Mr. Arturo Bones Rodriguez, a member of the Crusade for Justice, activist of the Chicano movement. ¿Cómo estás, compañero?
Muy bien, gracias. Saludos a todos. Oh, yes, yes, we did hear the sad news in Denver. We are mourning. The gente are collaborating to see how we can join the national mourning of Bañero and leader.
When did you first meet Reyes López Tijerina?
I met Reyes during the late 60s and early 70s through my activism and membership with the Crusade for Justice. I did not meet him at the time of the Poor People's Campaign, unfortunately, pero I did have a conversation with him several times in Denver. And we followed his work and supported him throughout the entire time that he was active, and even the time when he was released from prison and so forth. And so I knew the man on a personal level, basically by working in the Movimiento and the support that we have for each other's organization.
Exactly. And can you tell me about the man? You know, how was he, his character? How did he come across? Was he a humble man? ¿Cómo era él?
Well, you know, it's a time period when militancy in the Movimiento is new, but it's old. And what I'm talking about, his character was very, very assertive, but also very humble. His worldview was very challenging to the Movimiento, his philosophy. Of course, his action that he took, you know, spoke louder than his palabras. You know, when you take the action that he took in Nuevo Mexico, the courthouse raid, and also teaching and practicing self-defense, you know, which is a constitutional right, the right to bear arms, the right to freedom of speech. He was a very, very predominant figure. Some, you know, he's been likened to Malcolm X, who Malcolm X talked about by any means necessary, while Reyes lived by any means necessary. So he caught the imagination of people, and like Corky Gonzalez. Corky Gonzalez was also referred to as the Malcolm X of the Chicano movement. So he was a man of many, many characters, very intelligent, family man. Of course, as he gains more national recognition, like all human beings, you know, we tend to sometimes, our ego may be bigger than the human being. And so there were criticisms about him in terms of trying to cast the spotlight in the Poor People's Campaign. And so that criticism is both good and bad, but he was a man. He was a human being, and he was a man of his time. Certainly he left us a legacy, and we need to be able to capture that and to talk about. It's okay for us to talk about those things that were that maybe people perceive as negative. And but you know, those are lessons that we need to learn from, just like we learn from the lessons of Pancho Villa. He was not a totally positive character in some people's analysis, you know. And the same thing with other great revolutionaries.
Exactly, and that's what some people forget, is that we're all human beings, we all make mistakes. But that's not an excuse either, ¿verdad? It's just no. it is what it is. And this is what you got. And he was the right moment, he was the right person at the right moment at the right time, who was the only one who was able to go against the federal government and challenge them directly on the land grant issue and win in court.
Exactly. One experience that always sticks out of my mind is that when Reyes was in prison, he asked Gorky Gonzalez to head the Alianza, and which Gorky did.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that for several months. So that whole dynamic of Reyes trusting Gorky to head the Alianza at a time when the Alianza is very vulnerable. Is vulnerable to the federal COINTELPRO, to Reyes Lopez being incarcerated, to delete the natural leaders within the Alianza. The whole dynamic of a rural and urban transition of leadership is very important. And I haven't read too much that through scholarship, and I haven't really heard a lot of that discussed in movement circles. And I think it really is a lesson that we need to focus on, because, you know, for Reyes to empower Gorky and ask him to do that and Gorky to accept it at a time when the Crusade for Justice is in dire need of Gorky's everyday leadership in Denver, but also what's going on nationally. You're talking about a time when there are so many things happening, and also the repressive parts, the repression that's happening for our people is tremendous. And so for Gorky to do that and take key members of the Crusade for Justice for months to Tierra Maria is an incredible lesson for us to learn from. And we can't forget about that. Most people don't even know or remember that happened.
Exactly.
Well, in closing, I would like to encourage everybody to honor Reyes for the sacrifices that he made for us. And for him, all the work that he gave, and I think that's very important for us to carry on his spirit, carry on his actions. El que viva Reyes López Tejerina presente.
And we are here with the chairman of the National Brown Berets de Aztlán, Mr. David Rico.
You know, the first thing I would like to say, man, that the passing of Reyes is a terrible loss for the Chicano movement, for one thing. He's going to be remembered by a lot of people. He represents to us not only the things that were happening at the time that he was active in, around, I guess, in 1964, when he was talking about the land grants and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. He was talking about justice for all of us. He was going to prove to people who have probably never heard of it before of how that land was manipulated and how that land was illegally taken away from the rightful people. And he was going to take up that cause, or nobody else would think it was even possible. He was a great, he was a great speaker. Of course, there was a lot of criticism with Reyes when he first came on to view of a lot of people. But the important thing I think to remember about Reyes is, first of all, nobody's perfect. I mean, Pancho Villa and Zapata weren't perfect, and they had a lot of criticism as well. But it was more about what he represented. And he represented that we needed justice for our people as a whole. And he took on the idea of the land grant. The other thing he served is he put history in our hands. When he was talking about Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, he was talking about the end of the Mexican-American War. And many of us just hear about that in school. But he brought it to life. He brought those things that happened at that time, he brought it to the modern world. He says those things that happen are affecting us today. And there's a chance that if we unite, we could undo some of the injustices they did against our people. And not only that, I'm going to show you how it was done and who done it. I'm going to show you through the land grants and how they were manipulated, how they were, and we got that land stolen from us. He did his research, but more than just that, he was a call to action. You know, the one thing funny about the situation that he really never called himself a Chicano, but at the time, when there was other leaders talking about Chicano, he became a Chicano leader. He's identified with the Chicano movement of the 1960s and 70s and 80s. You know, with a lot of respect, whether he liked it or not, you could say he was drafted into it. He was a major inspiration to not just Chicanos in Nuevo Mexico, but in Califa, Arizona, you know, everywhere. And when he organized a raid in the courthouse, and that was something that everyone just would be inspired by that, because somebody is saying, you know what, not only do we have the right to do this, they also have the responsibility to do this and to arrest those people who are illegally, you know, taking our land from us. And he convinced a lot of people that it was true, and it was true. And those things that he said then, you know, are still true today. And many other things that happened to us, whether, I don't care what it is, bilingual education or police brutality, how the system manipulates the laws, and or it makes it difficult for us to get any justice. And that was the same thing with the land grant. And that was just but he took on. But that symbolized a lot of other things, a lot of other injustices that we had. And so that was, you know, in Chicano studies classes, I don't think you can take a Chicano studies class without talking about López Tejerina, because he was a major influence in the Chicano movement, and he becomes, and he still is, a symbol of that movement. And it was a time when we had other leaders out there, but he was in a class, you know, all by himself, and he's respected by many of the people that were in the movement at the time, and even today, he studied. There's a book on the courthouse raid and the implementation of that raid had to do with the laws that were set down in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and other documents saying that these lands belong to our people, and that they need to be returned, and we need to take steps for our own self-determination. And he was a symbol of that, and I just keep saying that over and over. I mean, he is a major symbol, and always will be, a symbol of self-determination of the Chicano and Mexicano people, even though he didn't use the word Chicano. I think he used to like to use Hispano Indio was his term, but he was still a major influence in the Chicano movement. And it's a great loss.
Welcome. Tonight we have Mr. Jose Angel Gutierrez here on the line with us. He is, of course, the founder of La Raza Unida Party, also a professor at University of Texas, and a Chicano lawyer, ¿verdad?
That's correct.
Right.
I don't think the state bar of Texas differentiates between Chicanos, blacks, or whites. If you've got a bar card, you're in good standing, you're a lawyer.
Well, good. We're here to discuss a little bit about Reyes López Tijerina. Of course, he passed away at age 88. ¿Qué me puedes decir?
He was one of the champions, the two champions of La Raza, especially during the era of the Chicano movement. Matt Meyer and Feliciano Rivera, historians, called him and three others the four horsemen of the Chicano movement. And Reyes was the Chicano Malcolm X. I mean, he was a warrior.
Of course. And you are also considered one of those other three, ¿verdad? And I want to thank...
Well, yeah, but we're talking about Reyes.
Yes.
And I'm the last one standing. I'm still alive.
There you go. But we have to acknowledge you, también, because you carry that credibility and you gave your all what you can for us, también. But let's get back to Reyes. Reyes was a very spiritual man. What can you tell me about his spirituality?
Well, he, you know, his early training, he was a migrant kid, kind of without a mother. She died early in their career, so they traveled the crops with the father, and basically uneducated, illiterate, until he ran into a Bible study class, and he got hooked into the Assemblies of God and became an ordained minister over time. That's where he learned how to read and write through the scriptures, and then he learned his oratory. As all ministers do, they get training in public speaking. So he became formidable, and able to speak in Spanish and English. And because he could read and begin to analyze, you know, the message of the Bible, for example, he was able then to go and, believe it or not, read 17th century, 18th century Spanish, Castilian Spanish in the archives in Spain and Mexico, because he internationalized the Chicano movement. He had this thought that our land was stolen by whites in the Southwest, so he went to look at the actual records in Mexico and Spain and see, well, you know, who got these grants, who were the owners, and how did this happen? So he taught himself how to analyze and become a lawyer. Later, when he was charged with crimes, he defended himself and was acquitted most of the time, especially for the Tierra Maria courthouse raid. He ended up pleading guilty to a destruction of federal property so his wife wouldn't go to prison. And so he ended up doing time in prison for a crime he didn't commit. But he pled to that. He didn't want his wife, the mother of his children, to be in prison.
Now, you knew him very, very personally. When was the first time that you met him? Can you remember?
Yeah, I do. Exactly, because my son, the firstborn, Adrian, was about, maybe... a year old, not even quite. And Reyes was calling people to come to his defense, that he was under attack violently by, you know, militias and armed people in New Mexico. So we went, and I remember we camped out, and it was quite dramatic. The confrontation there with armed people shooting at us, because we were occupying the Echo Amphitheater and other national parks in the area. That was one of his tactics. The land, two-thirds of the land west of the Mississippi is held by the federal government and state government in parks. Well, whose land is that? That's our land and Native American land. not to mention all the homestead acres. There was 600,000 claims, 310 million acres of land given away to European immigrants. Not to mention the sections of land, 1,097 square miles of land given to build the Transcontinental Railroad. He documented all this, and he put it in his biography, autobiography, that I translated later into English because nobody could read Spanish. So, you know, this was the message that he put out, and when we were all enamored with his guts, his courage, political courage, and his defense of La Raza, he introduced us to our baptismal certificates, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, the Treaty of Velasco, las leyes de las partidas españolas, for example. He was quite a character in educating us, opening our eyes to the land theft as to why we were made poor and by whom, when.
Now, you had a lot of contact with him throughout the years. What would you say personally about him? Was he a humble man? Was he an arrogant man? ¿Cómo era él?
No, I don't think he was arrogant. You know, he was convinced of the righteousness of his cause. Now, sometimes that is perceived as being arrogant when you don't allow, you know, other opinions. But that's what it takes to be a leader. You know, you got to have the conviction and the courage of your beliefs. And that's how you gather followers. So he was very convinced that he was right. And he pursued justice for the people by trying to get the land back. Of course, he didn't quite succeed, but that doesn't matter. It's not how many times you fight. It's, you know, how well you do the fight. Whether you win or lose is immaterial. It's carrying the fight forward.
Exactly, and that's what's important. A lot of people don't realize the importance, the legacy that he's going to leave behind. Do you think, I know that, you know, a movie was made about him in Spanish. Of course, he wrote his book, Mi Lucha por Mi Tierra, and you translated it. That's They Call Me King Tiger, ¿verdad? And
yes.
Would you say that we need to make a movie about him?
Well, Larry Cano, a producer out of California, had such a contract, and then it was pulled because people alleged that Reyes was anti-Semitic, and, you know, there is a lot of Jewish influence in Hollywood. So they pulled it. Now I understand that because of his death, there's renewed interest in, who is this guy? Who is this Chicano Malcolm X? So Larry Cano has a signed contract, and he's got an offer from some big studio, you know, and the seed money there from some time now. So he may do it. It should be done.
So let's talk about that, a little bit about that criticism. You know, they called him anti-Semitic. They called him violent. They called him that he treated women badly. But the critics, it's always easy to criticize when you're not in the firing line, ¿verdad?
Well, it's always easy to criticize, especially, as you say, when you're not in the firing line. But on the anti-Semitic business, it's quite simple from my understanding and my personal experience. I was there listening to him many, many times in different speeches and traveled with him when we did certain things together, like we went to the Unidos conference in Washington, D.C. He paralleled the loss of the land of the Palestinians contemporarily to the loss of the Southwest lands at the hands of gringos from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
He made that parallel. Well, when you do that, you cannot help but talk about Jews taking the land away from the Palestinians. There was no Jewish state prior to 1949. So, and now there's no Aslan because they took it after 1848. So he made those parallels, and that's where he got attacked for being anti-Semitic. He also was very careless. You know, he talked about Jews and did not say the Zionists. The Zionists are the ones who were rabid, who were really racist. But he just kind of blanket talked about the Jews in general. So he was kind of careless in his talk. But that doesn't make him anti-Semitic. You know, so like when I get accused of being anti-gringo because I use the word, well, you know, that doesn't mean that there's not good gringos out there. But you just kind of put everybody together. So you're kind of careless and not being precise. And that was the biggest problem. The other thing about the women, well, you know, he didn't have old school kind of training. Like I told you, he grew up without a mother. You know, it was basically all boys in the family, four brothers and the father. So, you know, he kind of didn't have much regard for the utility of women in the movement other than being supporting roles. And his wife, Maria Escolar, the first wife, that's exactly what she did. She she took care of that the fire was burning at home, that she went out and worked and earned money because Reyes didn't work for a salary, you know. So she was important. Without Maria Escobar, Reyes would not have been accomplished to what he did. But he didn't give credit, like many of us back then did not give credit. We still don't give credit to the role of women, but they're there, centrally involved.
Exactly, but it wasn't, I don't think it was done on purpose. I think that was a societal, you know, thing that was going on. And people try to apply political correctness, which I think is being very implosive, to people that are historical figures, trying to apply our values and morals of today to 60 years ago, 100 years ago.
Yeah, and people are loose in their talk. For example, you hear this all the time. Oh, he's acting very macho, as if somehow, you know, it's inherent to the Latino culture, and yet they're talking about whites or blacks or anybody else. Well, he's acting real macho-like, as if, you know, it's a birth defect that we come with.
Right.
But it's a stereotype, and people use it this way because we are very careless and loose in how we talk.
Right, correct. And what else can you tell me about Reyes?
Well, he never gave up, you know. I mean, after he went to prison, as conditions of his parole, because I do have his FBI file and I have his Bureau of Prisons files. One of the conditions of the parole was that he could never be a leader and talk about the land grant cause anymore. So, you know, he kind of got silenced unless he wanted to go back to prison. And he was ill already with some diseases, you know, that all of us get when we get older. And so, you know, he took off to Mexico since he was ineffective here. The movement also passed him by. You know, the movement doesn't wait on you. You may think you're indispensable, but the movement doesn't wait on anybody. And so he couldn't find his niche. He couldn't get back in here. He tried to talk about peace and harmony and, you know, scientific studies and, you know, all these things. The nuclear holocaust that was about to come, and nobody would listen anymore. So he left and went to Mexico. That's where he married the third wife. The second wife was Patricia. She was the one involved with the taking of the forests and, you know, so on. Esperanza is the third wife, and he's been married to her for 22 years. He was in Mexico for a long time because I was with him when López Portillo gave him a home and some property so he could be safe in Mexico as opposed to here. And then when his illnesses got too bad for him or too much for him, he moved to El Paso. And Salvador Barcorta, who during the heyday of the movement, he was a 14-year-old little kid and a bodyguard to me and the Raza Unida Party, he is now the director of La Fez Health Center. So that's where Reyes went and got treatments. Reyes, because he didn't work for a salary, didn't have Social Security, didn't have a pension, didn't have money.
Mm-hmm.
And the wife being a Mexican, without being citizen of the United States, she's not entitled to any money, so they kind of lived by, you know, hand to mouth. They're near the clinic in a hovel in a apartment there in Segundo Barrio. It was terrible to see how bad off he was. But we don't take care of our heroes. We don't take care of our leaders. And so he was there for medical treatment and finally, you know, couldn't deal with it. He refused to take surgeries. He refused to have the medical procedures necessary. He said he wanted to die as a complete man.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he did.
Exactly.
2 days ago.
Exactly. And we will always remember him as a great leader, as a, in that great legacy that he leaves us behind. You know, again, he introduced the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. He integrated the jury. I believe nine Mexican Americans sat on his jury when he went to trial, and he won, of course. And he did a bunch of other stuff that people will have to acknowledge whether they like it or whether they don't, ¿verdad?
Well, you know, one of the most remarkable things, because he's looked at as a very violent person, and I even call him and other people call him the Chicano Malcolm X. Well, neither he nor Malcolm ever took up arms, you know, against people.
Right.
They defended themselves, and they said we had the right to defend ourselves. But Tijerina was very astute. He studied the law. He studied these laws in the books and things. He used the citizen's arrest. He went to arrest the scientists at the Los Alamos for creating an atomic bomb. He went to arrest Warren Burger, the Supreme Court Justice of the United States, for not enforcing the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. That's the first Chief Justice, who couldn't come out the front door of the Supreme Court upon his announcement that Fiorina was out there waiting to arrest him with a citizen's arrest, which is what the power we have. That's still on file at the Supreme Court building. Berger had to go out the back door to avoid Tijerina. You know, Tijerina did some very innovative things. You know, he was the partner to Martin Luther King Jr. when the Poor People's Campaign. He was the spokesperson for La Raza. And I was there. I was a witness. You know, he said, the rights of the Indians got to come first. Then the blacks. We can be the last ones to receive justice. That's the order he put out there. So he was very admired for being magnanimous. The first the Indios, because that's where the land came from to begin with.
Exactly.
Then the African Americans for all the exploitation of slavery, and then us, you know, for the loss of land and the removal of our rights here in the Southwest.
All right, Mr. Jose Angel Gutierrez, I want to thank you for joining us. Any last comments?
Well, que viva mucho Reyes López Tijerina presente. His memory will always be with us. In case people are interested, you know, the rosary for him is going to be on Friday in El Paso. The viewing at the funeral home, Harding Orr McDaniel Funeral Home on Montana, will be the viewing of the body and a rosary there at that funeral home. On Saturday at noon at Sagrado Corazon in El Paso, there will be the mass, the memorial mass. So the public is invited to attend, and hopefully people that are listening may want to make the sacrifice to attend the funeral, just like we did for Chavez and Corky. You know, this is our great leader who's fallen and is moving on, so we need to show our respects.
Exactly. This is a historical moment, and people should make the pilgrimage to go out there and participate, ¿verdad?
I would hope so.
Exactly.
I'll be there.
Exactly. So we're talking about January 30th and 31st of 2015. So thank you once again, Mr. Jose Angel Gutierrez, one of the four Chicano horsemen of our movement, of our times. I want to thank you for joining us and giving us your comments.
You're welcome. Good night.
Ándale. Adios. Welcome to Chicano Highlights. Tonight, we have a very special guest. I am your host, the Beto Man, and we have here Esperanza Tijerina, ¿verdad?
Sí.
¿Cómo estás?
Bien, pues triste, bien en salud, pero triste por la separación de Reyes.
Uh-huh. Ok, pues vamos a comenzar. ¿De dónde son tus padres?
Mis padres son de Michoacán, precisamente de Uruapan, Michoacán.
Ajá, ¿y cómo se llaman?
Mi padre se llamaba Ignacio García, mi madre Olivia Valladares. Eran campesinos y de descendencia de campesinos.
Ah, mira nomás. ¿Tienes hermanas y hermanos?
Tengo en la actualidad ahorita 3 hermanas y 1 hermano.
Ah, ¿todos están vivos?
Sí, ya murieron 2 hombres y 1 mujer.
Okay. ¿Y dónde creciste tú?
En Uruapan, Michoacán.
¿Toda tu vida?
Toda mi vida, sí.
Okay. ¿Y dónde fuiste a la escuela?
Allí en Uruapan, primero a un colegio católico y después a una escuela oficial.
Okay, dime un poquito de trabajos que tuviste en tu vida.
Mi vida, todo el tiempo de soltera, me dediqué a ser modista. Hacía ropa para damas, para mujer,
uh-huh,
niñas y señoras.
Okay. Y luego, ¿cómo conociste a Reyes López Tijerina?
A Reyes López Tijerina lo conocí por medio de una amiga mía y un amigo de Reyes. Reyes, el amigo de Reyes era tío de mi amiga. Llegaron allí a un bloque, a una cuadra de donde yo vivía, como ya le cosía a su familia, ella se llama Angélica, y era amigo de Reyes Salvador. Entonces, ellos nos presentaron. Y de allí empezamos una, primero con una amistad por medio de cartas. Reyes me escribió por 20 días una carta diaria.
Ah, sí, ajá. ¿Y qué pensó de él?
Pues, realmente cuando me escribía, no, y el transcurso de todo el tiempo, a pesar de que me dejó su libro, no conocía su vida bien, no la comprendí, hasta cuando me casé, y al pasar aquí al paso, fue cuando empecé a conocer su vida, su lucha. Aunque él me platicó a lo que se dedicaba, él, una cosa que me dijo es, dije, ya estoy jubilado. Pero en ese sentido me engañó, porque no está jubilado, porque siguió en su lucha, siguió escribiendo por 15 años que antes de que se enfermara, su diario todos los días, y pues vi que era un hombre que amaba la justicia y muy dedicado a su pueblo.
So,
lo llamaba él.
¿Cuándo se casaron?
Nos casamos el 9 de junio aquí por el civil, y como nos casamos en Iglesia Católica, el 19 de junio de 1993 en Uruapan, Michoacán.
Ah, mira nomás. Y luego, ¿ahí se quedaron y por un tiempo?
No, nos venimos para acá, al paso. Me dio un poco de trabajo pasar la frontera, porque él no sabía, él pensaba que nomás que con decir que estaba casada con él me iban a dar el pase, y hasta allí le explicaron. Saqué un permiso, nos pasé y fuimos hasta Coyote. Allá estuve 3 meses.
Sí.
Y después, como yo no me sentía a gusto, me regresé. Y él, a los 2 meses fue, estábamos allá cuando le quemaron, su rancho, sus casas en el rancho.
Uh-huh.
Entonces, pues ya no podía venirme porque ya no había dónde vivir.
Uh-huh.
Pasaron los meses y después él decidió irse, le gustó vivir en Uruapan y allá vivió por 10 años.
Uh-huh. ¿Y supieron quién le quemó el rancho?
Pues, él decía que en esos días se habían quemado la oficina de la floresta, y él creía que se la habían quemado en venganza de que le quemaron la oficina.
Uh-huh.
Pero cuando quemaron la oficina, tampoco él estaba, en la oficina de la floresta, tampoco él estaba por acá.
Uh-huh.
Así es que... Pero él creía que eso.
Sí, porque la gente le tiene miedo y le tiene odio, ¿verdad?
Uh-huh.
Sí. Eso se quedó ahí por 10 años. Y él tenía problema con el diabetes, ¿verdad?
Sí, desde que yo lo conocí tenía problemas con el diabetes.
Ah, ¿y qué pasó?
Pues allá estaba más o menos bien. Por el clima le ayudaba mucho. La alimentación era diferente, la fruta, verdura, todo eso era fresca y la comía con más gusto, pero luego después empezó a sentirse mal y decidió que nos viniéramos a la frontera. Me arregló mi residencia y me pasé, y aquí ya nos establecimos en El Paso. Le gustó estar aquí. Y aquí murió, aquí. Vivimos por 7 años y él por 8.
Sí,
porque
sí.
Él se vino antes que yo.
Pero hubo un tiempo que él estuvo bien malo del diabetes y estaba en cama, ¿verdad?
En Europa le dio la neuropatía diabética y estuvo prácticamente 2 años. Un muy malo, 6 meses no caminó. Se lo trajeron aquí a Albuquerque. Y le dijeron que no tenía remedio, que se regresara. También allá en Uruapan le decía que no tenía remedio. que ya no tenía cura, que no iba a volver a caminar. Pero yo dije que después de Dios lo haría caminar. Y gracias a Dios sí lo hice caminar. Pero ya después con el tiempo siguió el problema y volvió a recaer. Uh-huh. Pero todos modos sí caminaba un poco. Pero ya en los últimos 3 meses ya no caminaba.
Uh-huh. Sí, está bien duro, ¿verdad? Ahora, ¿tú lo has visto platicar? ¿Fuiste a las juntas con él, las conferencias? ¿Qué pensabas de él como líder, ¿verdad? Del movimiento y cómo se presentaba.
Pues presentaba como una persona muy del pueblo, muy cerca del pueblo. No se creía superior a él, al pueblo. Él siempre nombró mi pueblo. Él nunca dijo mis seguidores ni nada, sino decía mi pueblo. Yo pues lo vi pocas veces presentarse porque ya entonces ya no era tanto por su misma enfermedad, ya era poco lo que asistía. Tenía mucho amor a su causa, como él le decía, su lucha, y por su lucha murió, porque su lucha fue la que causó las enfermedades, las persecuciones, y los ayunos que trataba de hacer, porque pues donde andaba escondiéndose, no comía bien, no se alimentaba, se desvelaba mucho, porque cuando recién casados, que estábamos juntos, él se levantaba a las 2, 3 de la mañana y escribía o leía mucho. A veces dormía 3, 4 horas, aunque durmiera en el día, pero estudiaba mucho, como decía él. Era una gran variedad de libros que tenía y leía bastante y se cultivaba. Sí. Fue un hombre autodidacta, como se dice en español.
Sí, 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 es muy cierto, ¿verdad? Él ya mucho era muy educado, él se educaba solo, ¿verdad? Hay muchos críticos y mucha gente, pues, mala, ¿verdad? De mala fe, que dice que Reyes era malo con las mujeres, que no le gustaba a los judíos. ¿Qué me puede decir de eso?
Pues yo no sé cómo haya sido con sus otras esposas, ahí no puedo saber porque yo estaba muy lejos. Conmigo creo que era como cualquier matrimonio, que había altas y bajas, pero pues creo que si hubiera sufrido bastante, como a veces dicen, yo me hubiera quedado en Uruapan o nos hubiéramos divorciado. En ese aspecto creo que no que era normal como algunos matrimonios.
Ahora él también conocía mucha gente, ¿verdad? ¿Cómo trataba a la gente que se venía y se presentaba con él?
Pues yo lo veía que la trataba bien, bien. Últimamente lo que pasaba, muy sincero, cuando se cansaba decía, ya me cansé y ya no hablo más. Era tajante. Pero cuando todavía estaba más fuerte, a veces duraba hablando con ellos hasta 6-7 horas. Uh-huh. Yo en una ocasión, una persona que fue a entrevistarlo allá, duró 7 horas y nomás tomaba agua. Uh-huh. Y veía que los trataba bien. Últimamente era cuando era muy cortante porque se cansaba.
Pues sí, eso es natural. Mucha de la gente no sabe que ya tenía que los 88 años, ¿verdad? Sí. Y pues la gente pues sí se cansa y tienes que dar el respeto al momento, ¿verdad? Para que puede recuperar la energía. Su familia, ¿verdad? Estuvo casado 2 veces, ¿verdad?
Tres veces conmigo.
Pues sí, pues natural, ¿verdad?
Tres veces. Pero yo fui el tercer matrimonio. Ajá. Yo nunca, a mí me decían que era la tercera esposa y yo nunca me ha gustado que primera, ni segunda, ni tercera. Yo les decía, yo soy la esposa actual.
La única.
Actual, ahorita. Ajá. Atrás, ¿cuántas tuvo? No lo sé. Si tuvo o no tuvo. Yo soy la actual esposa.
Ajá, ajá. y sus hijos y todos sus hijos, ¿cómo están ahorita?
Pues como viven en Albuquerque, realmente ahí sí no sé, y poco viajamos, mejor dicho, no viajábamos para allá por su problema de su salud.
Sí, y todavía tienen una celebración en Tierra María, ¿verdad? Cada año.
Cada año tienen una celebración. Algunas, pues yo asistí a 3 celebraciones, nada más.
Uh-huh.
Y ya después, en una ocasión nos quedamos ya para salir porque él se puso mal y ya no. Y ya se detuvo.
Okay. Ahora, dime un poquito de lo que pasó este el sábado, que era el 17, cuando falleció, 2015, ¿verdad?
Tenía mucho tiempo que no quería acostarse y no duraba acostado. Ese día era la 1 de la mañana y yo le insistí, le rogaba que se acostara, que porque así no iba a descansar, que de menos acostado descansaba y no quiso. Empezó a bromear de cosas muy raras porque no le gustaba bromear. Y entonces empezó a decir que decían que él tenía, dice, todos me culpan que sufren porque yo los hice sufrir. ¿Y a quién voy a culpar yo de lo que estoy sufriendo?
Sí, cierto.
Ahí sí no sé.
Uh-huh.
Entonces dijo, pues culparé a mi madre, a mi padre, pero era un repetir. Se quedaba tranquilo y volvía a decir. Luego dice, o a Dios, y al rato volví a repetir, pero luego se paró y dice, yo ya no reculpo a nadie ni nada, yo ya me puse en paz con todo, yo ya ni debo ni me debe, yo ya estoy tranquilo. Bueno, le dije, ahora sí a la cama. Se volteó y quedó volteado boca arriba.
Uh-huh.
Y dijo, ya no puedo.
Uh-huh.
Entonces estaba, le dije, te ayudo, y al dejar yo,
okay,
iba a dar una pastilla, al dejar el agua, volteo para ayudarlo y no respiraba.
Ajá, ¿y luego qué pasó?
Entonces le dije, no me estés jugando, bueno, lo vi que no pude voltear, le dije, no me estés engañando, le voy a hablar, pero ya desesperada, le voy a hablar a los bomberos, decía él, le dije, le voy a hablar. Pero vi que no, entonces rápido cogí el teléfono, hablé, están aquí al voltear de la calle,
uh-huh.
Vinieron rápido, se lo llevaron, no ni siquiera, luego, porque yo les estaba diciendo qué había pasado, se lo llevaron y ya fue al hospital. Allá lo respiró, volvió a respirar, y que le hicieron un tratamiento que iba a durar 48 horas. Entonces,
pero de ese punto ya nunca habló, ¿verdad? Ya nunca despertó.
Ya nunca habló. Lo último que dijo, normal, bien, dijo, yo ya estoy en paz, ni me deben ni les debo.
Mm. Sí.
Estas fueron sus últimas palabras.
Mm.
Pero eso ya era cuando ya estaba.
Sí.
Porque le tenía que dar una píldora y al querer dar la píldora volteo y pongo el vaso rápido y trato para enderezarlo. Pero ya, o sea, fue cosa de segundos.
Sí. Hablando de Reyes, era un hombre muy espiritual y él creía en los sueños, ¿verdad? Y en Dios, ¿verdad? Tenía tanta fe en Dios. ¿Qué me puedes decir de eso?
Él esperaba la venida de Cristo.
Uh-huh.
Y la resurrección. Uh-huh. Él era su siempre que iba a venir Cristo, pero él esperaba, dice, yo creo que voy a estar aquí, pero puede ser que yo sea de los resucitados. O sea, estaba en una cosa y en otra, pero él creía en la venida de Cristo.
Sí.
Respetaba, admiraba a Buda, a Mahoma y a Cristo. decía que los tres eran personas muy grandes. Él no criticaba una religión, ni la otra, ni la otra.
Mm.
Él todo lo que fuera y llegara hacia el Creador.
Sí, un hombre muy lindo y bonito, ¿verdad?
Sí.
Pensando del matrimonio de ustedes, ¿verdad? ¿Cómo va a seguir usted sin él?
Yo me voy a quedar aquí en El Paso.
Uh-huh.
Pienso seguir, pues, en lo que pueda ayudar a su lucha. Se lo habría hablado desde antes. Hablar lo que él me enseñó. Leer sus libros, nomás que para eso necesito aprender inglés.
Ajá.
Y eso le prometí. Desde años atrás, desde que lleguemos aquí al Paso, que yo iba a hablar, por eso todos el material que tú me has enviado, lo conservo, lo guardo, lo colecciono para aprender. Y se lo dije, todo esto me va a servir para yo enseñar a la gente que no sabe por lo que tú estás luchando.
Sí, esa es la cosa, ¿verdad? Que mucha gente tiene los ojos cerrados y no se fijan qué importante es Reyes López Tijerina a la lucha. Y como te digo, hay muchos críticos, mucha gente de mala fe que le tienen odio y lo quieren demandar, ¿verdad? Pero no se puede, porque Reyes fue el único de todo el movimiento que pudo ser lo que él sió. Nadie más lo sió y lo van a poder ser, porque él fue, como te digo, apuntado por Dios.
Sí, sí, él fue apuntado. Hombres como él son muy raros en este mundo, muy raros. Yo creo que en siglos volverán a ser otro rey Tijerina.
¿Verdad que sí?
Sí.
Sí, poquito a poquito.
Yo lo digo que en siglos no volverá a haber otro.
Sí, porque cierto.
Sí, fue un hombre muy inteligente, muy dado a fe, lo que él creía, lo creía ciegamente.
Uh-huh.
Y no habrá otro.
Sí, sí, sí. Yo sé que está bien duro para ti por estos tiempos, ¿verdad? Triste, pero tenemos que luchar cada día para su futuro, el futuro de Reyes, la historia que vamos a dejar de él, para que los niños saben quién es y a tratar de nombrar las bibliotecas, las calles en el nombre de él, para que se recuerden de él, para que sepan quién es.
Sí, tenemos que luchar y conquistar nuestro lugar, como él lo decía. No nos toman en cuenta. Dicen que somos blancos, pero no nos atienden como blancos. Ya no existe la palabra indohispano en algunas horas que andábamos arreglando sus papeles. Ahí le preguntaban que qué era, si blanco, africano o japonés o mexicano, pero no decía lo como él decía, indohispano, porque indohispano somos hasta la Patagonia. Somos una mezclanza del indio y del español.
Uh-huh.
No hay un pureza en la sangre, pero es indohispano. Y ya nos están borrando eso, que somos indohispano.
Sí.
Ya nada más es blanco o el color, o amarillo.
Sí, sí, cierto.
Ya no nos quieren quitar eso. Y eso es lo que tenemos que enseñarles a los niños, que somos indohispanos y que estamos con una nueva cultura y que somos la raza de bronce.
¿Verdad que sí? Sí, es muy cierto. Bueno, unas palabras, ¿qué le dirás a los niños de Reyes López Tijerina?
Les decía que estudien, que aprendan, que lean todo lo que más pueda. La más que la escuela, la cultura está en los libros. porque se fijen qué tipo de libros, qué es lo que quieren aprender, qué es lo que quieren ser, porque no nada más es coger un libro y ya, hay que saber qué libro leer. Él llegó a donde llegó por su tenacidad de leer. Su primer libro, y por muchos años, fue la Biblia. La Biblia es uno de los grandes libros, que es un libro de los que no se ha imprimido como... Ningún otro libro se ha imprimido como la Biblia. Es uno, y hay muchos otros libros que se pueden leer. Pueden leer a Buda, a Mahoma, para que tengan fe en su corazón, para que haya... Y después pueden leer todo lo demás, pero siempre y cuando que los llegue a conocer la verdad, a saber quiénes son y a saber qué la tierra que están pisando. Uh-huh. Porque esta tierra es del indohispano. Eso es lo que Reyes decía, y eso es lo que yo digo, porque en sus 22 años me lo grabó a cincel en mi pecho. Esta tierra es de los indohispanos y tenemos que pelear y luchar por ella, pero hacerlo con hombres y mujeres de bien, no nada más sino hombres y mujeres de bien.
Sí. Ahora él escribió un libro. ¿Cómo se llama el libro de él?
Mi lucha por la tierra.
Uh-huh. Y dices que sí lo leíste, ¿verdad?
Ah, lo leí como unas 20 veces. Cuando teníamos algo duda, lo sacábamos y lo volvíamos a leer.
Ajá.
Lo leíamos entre los dos.
Ajá.
O a veces él me decía, léeme esta parte. O yo le decía, esto dice en tu libro. Decía, no me acuerdo, y lo buscábamos. Lo leí muchas veces.
Ajá.
Muchas veces lo he leído.
¿Y qué piensas del libro de él?
Pues que escribió sus... parte de su historia, porque no dijo todo lo que es él, todo lo que ha trabajado y todo lo que luchó. Nomás sé que es parte de su historia.
Uh-huh.
Leí también todos sus 40 diarios que escribió, todos los leí. Una vez, pero los leí todos.
Uh-huh.
Cuando él se enfermó, se lo leí en Uruapan. Todos los días después de que terminaba yo de mis labores de la casa, le leía, hasta que le acabé de leer los 40 diarios que él escribió. Y ahí es donde más lo conocí.
Hicieron una película de Reyes López Tijerina que se llama Chicano.
Sí.
En 1976, ¿verdad? 76, ¿verdad? Sí miraste la película, ¿verdad?
Sí.
¿Y qué pensaste de la película?
Pues no me agradó mucho. Hay detallitos que no me agradaron. Desde que la vi hace como unos 15 años.
Uh-huh.
Pero porque no se comprende muy bien su lucha. Le dan un matiz muy, muy diferente. Me gustaría que hicieran una película muy... pues más apegada a la verdad, más apegada a la realidad. Porque su vida fue muy 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 grande. Y cada año y cada acción que hacía era nueva. Nunca hacía lo mismo de un año a otro. Nunca repetía lo mismo. Digo de lo que hacía en su lucha. Como la toma de Tierra Amarilla, cuando fue a arrestar al sheriff y a Washington,
uh-huh,
al juez,
uh-huh,
cuando fue a arrestar a aquí en Los Álamos,
uh-huh,
siempre había cosas que hacía nuevas, por eso fue donde se ganó la mala fama.
Mm. Y hay varios corridos de Reyes López Tijerina. ¿Qué piensa de los corridos?
Pues...
¿hay uno que te gusta más?
A mí me gustan todos, pero el último que me gusta, no sabemos quién lo hizo, uno donde dice que es famoso en todo el sur, en la frontera, donde cuenta casi toda su vida en muy breve, sin entrar a otros detalles, que lo llevaran a juicio y lo declararon inocente. Ese es el corrido que más me gusta. A él le gustaba mucho el que el primero que hicieron, por cuando dice que los niños y las mujeres lloraban, que el mundo se estaba acabando, porque dice que ese, me platicaba que ese corrido lo tocaron cuando él iba entrando a la prisión. Y dice que le causó, que lo hizo llorar, que no sabe si de gusto o de alegría, pero que no sabía en ese momento si de gusto o de alegría, pero que le gustó después porque el pueblo estaba despertando.
Exacto. Okay, bueno, pues aquí vamos a acabar. Quiero decir muchas gracias por la entrevista. Cualquier cosa que necesitas nos dice, ¿verdad? Aquí como parte del locutor, como parte de familia, lo que usted necesita, aquí estamos para ayudarle, nomás de preguntar, ¿verdad?
Sí. Pues muchas gracias que me dieron la oportunidad de hablar un poco de Reyes, de lo que significa para mí, porque mi vida cambió desde que fui conviviendo con él.
Se murió el día de Martin Luther King, ¿verdad?
Sí, o sea, aquí lo que pasó aquí fue el sábado, que, pero ya ves que se conmemora el tercer lunes, se conmemora. Entonces ese día murió. Y el martes, que ya amaneció muerto, pues iba a salir King en otros periódicos, en el español sale al frente el doctor King por las conmemoraciones que salieron. Él sale en el Paso Times. Él sale primero y el doctor King sale en medio. Así es que este señor hizo con nosotros y con todo lo que quiso.
Ajá.
Y lo sepultamos, todo termina en esto, este paso de la vida, todo termina el 2 de febrero, pero de ahí vamos a empezar una nueva vida.
Ajá.
Siempre con su recuerdo.
Sí,
siempre con su ejemplo.
Y luego fueron para buscando un cementerio, ¿verdad? Dime de eso.
Buscamos un cementerio. Primero, pues me dijeron que que íbamos a ir a cierto cementerio. Y me dijeron dónde estaba. Le dije, sí, ya lo conozco, ya fui por allá, por aquellos rumbos. Fuimos y no nos gustó, y no nos gustó cómo nos trataron. Nos salimos de allí enojados, molestos, no. Entonces un señor les dice, ¿por qué no van a donde sepultamos a mi papá? Está muy bonito. Y entonces ya, pues mañana vamos, hoy fuimos. Desde que entramos sentimos muy bonito. Ya ves que algunas personas no creen que los bultos, que los monos que representan ponen y que adoran. Yo en eso no me meto. Pero al entrar está un mono, si quieres decir, o que representa a Cristo o que sea, con los brazos abiertos, como que te está recibiendo. Eso es lo primero. Y luego al estar escogiendo los lugares, nos dijeron qué precio tenían cada jardín. Y un jardín, yo no me fijé, ni nadie se fijó cuando dijo que ese era el jardín, el Hop. Pero yo me fijé que era, al decirlo, pues dices Hop, pero me fijé y dije, pues es Esperanza. Le dije, este jardín, este, sí, se llama el Hop. O sea, The Hub, le dije yo, y me contestó la mujer. Le dije, pues ese es el que yo quiero.
En el nombre tuyo, ¿verdad?
Sí, pues es mi nombre. Y allí, ese señor que va a donar a una parte del cementerio, pidió que, o sea, él va a donar la tierra, nomás. Todo lo demás, él compró el pedacito de tierra. Dijo que quería un pedazo de tierra donde nos sepultaran a los dos. Así es que yo ya tengo mi sepultura aquí.
Ay, qué bueno. Ajá, qué bueno.
Con él.
Sí.
Como él quería. Qué que bueno. Estuviéramos los dos juntos.
Qué bueno.
No, salieron las cosas de maravilla.
¿Verdad que sí?
Doña, vamos a seguirle si Dios quiere y es lo que me inspira para seguir su lucha y su ejemplo. Muchas gracias.
And that's going to do it for us, Raza. You've been listening to Chicano Highlights. This has been your host, the Beto Man, and we will see you hasta la próxima. Ahí te guacho. The following is a speech held soon after the death of Martin Luther King with Reyes Lopez Tejerina at KPFA in Berkeley, California.
I'm in the studio with Reyes Lopez Tejerina, who is head of the organization called Federal Alliance of Free City States. Now, that is more commonly known, I believe, as the North New Mexico six-county land-grant movement, which you have headed.
Right.
I would like to begin where we began when you came into my office. Yesterday evening, early, we had the news of Martin Luther King's assassination. This morning, just as you walked into my office, some kind of a disturbance involving police cars and both black and white, obviously high school students, was taking place under the windows of KPFA's office. And I said, God help us all. And I liked your reply.
I said that God could not help us any longer. He has run out of patience, and we have mocked him too many times. We got him fed up, and I think that we are running out of time, and the patience of God is also running out. I don't think that we have left him any alternative, and he chose to help us. He has been trying to help us for hundreds and thousands of years, and we have been mocking his true justice, his true democracy, by destroying mankind and establishing our own kind of democracy. So that's why I feel that there's no way. This is a typical day, a typical act, the assassination, cold-blooded murder of the symbol of peace and the representation of the rights of the poor through a meek and wise man, Dr. King. The government, I feel, is responsible by encouraging, by not developing ways for the poor, ways for the oppressed, only ways and means for the bankers, for the powerful, for the whites. And that is why I feel that the federal government of the United States is pushing its own people to destruction, to the end of this empire.
You were dealing, I believe, with Dr. Martin Luther King about the proposed march on Washington, which was to take place on the 26th of this month. Could you tell us something about what those plans were?
In August the 26th to 28, 1967, I approached Martin Luther King in the airport of Chicago when they had this new politics convention. And I suggested to him a coalition between the brown people, the black people, also the Indians and poor whites. He said it was high time. And that was all. I didn't heard from him until this year. I think it was February, where he invited me to come to Atlanta, Georgia, March the 14th. I arrived in Atlanta, Georgia, and some 25 leaders of other organizations of the brown people. Also white people, Indian people, and black people. It was there that a coalition was formed. It was there that Dr. King talked to us. It was there that Dr. King reminded and point out to the people in that Paschal's Hotel in Atlanta, Georgia, that I had suggested to him the idea, and that he had embraced it, and it was high time. A steering committee was formed out of the various races and groups to steer and direct the coordination, the plans on the Washington March that is coming April the 22nd, and that will escalate up to June, probably June the 15th.
The committee will begin, will meet in Washington on the 22nd.
On the 22nd, right.
Will be and on the 26th, is that it?
Yes. The steering committee and about 100 leaders will visit various offices of the government departments and Congress. And then after that, 3,000 people will arrive to stay in the Capitol. And then after that, people will start arriving, according to the plans, by the thousands from all over the United States.
And this was to go on and build and build.
Escalate, yes.
Yes.
Yes, so this is one of the greatest plans. Perfection and the, I don't know how to put it in this second language of mine, but it was the greatest of the plans that Martin Luther King had come out with. It was something fantastic, beautiful, and it will be, I have no doubts, unless the committee changed the whole plan. But I understand, I have contact. I was called from Atlanta, Georgia, just last night, and up to now they're going ahead with the march.
And Reverend Abernathy, I believe, is taking Dr. King's place as head of the Leadership Conference.
Right.
Have you had a chance to speak with Dr. Abernathy?
No, not yet. However, I am invited personally by Reverend Abernathy to speak in his church in the very near future, a week or two, and I will be speaking to him.
And you are expecting then that from all over the country, the minority people will come to Washington over a period of time?
Yes, yes. Mexican-American, Spanish-American are uniting and recruiting people, just like the Indians and the black people, for this great march.
Well?
This was called by Martin Luther King Campaign for the Poor, the March for the Poor People.
I seem to recall that when he announced this march, that he said something about the fact that this would be the last massive attempt to convince the government and the American people by nonviolent means, and that if this was not successful, that he would not try again.
Right, yes, his philosophy had changed. His last speech, closed-door speech, was plain. He said this march would not represent civil rights but human rights. For the first time, the black people would ask for land, would demand for land, not just jobs, education, and housing, but land, just like the people in New Mexico are demanding land.
Well, perhaps we could talk now about what you are doing in northern New Mexico, how it started. You yourself were born in Texas, I believe.
Yes, in Falls City, Texas, September 21st, 1926.
In a field.
In a cotton field, yes, ma'am.
And you were your mother's fifth child.
I was my mother's fifth child, yes. It was around between 4 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon when my mother and my father were picking cotton, and the pains arrived, and it was there that I was born in a cotton sack, half full.
You see, I have a good memory. I heard you say this once before. And you grew up where?
I grew up around the San Antonio area up to 14. Then I left for the beet and tomato fields in Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan. At the age of 17, I started in a theological seminary for 3 years. I graduated, and then I was a minister for the following 10 years in Arizona while we were...
A minister. What kind of a minister?
Non-denominational Protestant minister.
But your family were agricultural workers, and you yourself worked in the fields as you grew up.
That was my trade, yes, field work.
When did you go to New Mexico?
I decided to... I had been there before, but I had refused to join the land claimants, the people that had been fighting and with the federal government and claiming certain rights under a treaty of Guadalupe that was signed between the United States and Mexico, February the 2nd, 1848. However, picking cotton in the fields of Arizona, the neighbors burned my house and 16 other houses of my fellow brothers who together had decided to build a little village called the Valley of Peace. In the period of 2-3 years, they burned our house, our church, our store, our school, 17 homes. After
who burned them?
The neighbors, Anglo-Americans, civilized Anglo-Americans.
Why?
Because we refused to send our children to their school, and because they thought we were communists. And Don Pelton, the FBI agent, was called to investigate. He refused flatly. Lawrence White, the sheriff of the Pinal County, was invited, or rather, asked many times to come and investigate the burnings. He refused flatly. And he was there and then that we decided to move into New Mexico. And that burning, destruction of our property, changed part of my life and the course of my life. From Bible religious teaching to civil and international law and land, which is what is involved in this whole struggle.
Now, the current struggle, which is going on, as I understand it, concerns 6 counties in northern New Mexico.
Well, really, it concerns the whole state. The land... we sometimes mention the 5 counties because it's where we make up the 90% of the population, and because we are face to face with federal government, and because the Department of Agriculture is there where it's holding most of the land that the President of the United States confiscated outright from the villages. However, the land grants, 350, are scattered throughout the whole state of New Mexico.
Yes, but the fight is concentrated for the moment around this particular area.
Right, but the members of the organization are scattered throughout the state and also Texas and California. But the showdowns, what we would call them, and the real trouble is in the northern part, yes.
Well, how did it start? I believe I recall something about... the fact that at some stage you decided to take over a village?
Well, to understand this and to inform the public, which has been deprived of the truth through the CBS and, UPI and Associated Press, who have been distorting the truth, I would like to state that the people of New Mexico, like the Hopi Nation, have never surrendered to the confiscation of the land, have never surrendered to the federal government and to their ideas which are against the 300-year-old system and way of livelihood in New Mexico. There is a group, there was and there is, called White Caps in the northern part of New Mexico. As the government built fences around this common land that belongs to the villages, during the day, the people cut the fence during the night, on and on for the last 100 years. The government have conspired in 1,000 ways to destroy the life, the culture, the language, the property of these people. He has not succeeded because he has not succeeded in pushing the people out of the northern part of New Mexico. So, It was in 1957 that I decided, when my property was burned, that I decided to investigate the claims, the cries of the people. I discovered that even though there were many pueblos, many people, they were not united. Every pueblo was for himself, just like the Indian pueblos. My first step after discovering that they held a true claim and that the treaty did stipulate the protection of such land, and that they did have the title, and the villages had title to this land, I decided to organize and unite the people of the various land grants, which are called pueblos. It is these pueblos who hold the land, who owns the land, not the individuals, not the heirs. The heirs hold certain rights through the village, through the pueblo council, or city council, as more popular called. And in 1963, after due and through investigation, I decided to organize the Alianza Federal de Mercedes, Federal Alliance of Land Grants, whose papers and documents were confiscated by the federal government in 1967, and then we decided to dissolve the organization and convert it into a political organization, which is now called Federal Alliance of Free City States. The fight has been going for the last 120 years. It is not true that we started the fight. In many local papers, it has been proven and written in the front page that the problem or the trouble did not started by with Tijerina. It was there. But the people had not succeeded in bringing their claim, their cry across the nation. See, the nation was ignorant of this organized conspiracy and criminal confiscation of the federal government against the people. It was there, and it has been there all the time. But the public has been kept ignorant of this fact. Only the local bankers, politicians, and rich men and ranchers know the fact. But they, in collusion with the news media, keep it quiet. Until now, they could no longer do it because the Alianza broke through the silence barrier. It was when we were to hold a meeting, a nationwide meeting in Coyote, New Mexico. Coyote is the Spanish word for coyote. So it was there we published it in news media, radio, press, and TV for a month. But there's a man that is being used by the senator of New Mexico, Senator Montoya, who wants to make a name for himself, and the news media provoked and teased this man by calling that meeting at Coyote a showdown day meeting between the people and the government. So making the state police believe that there was going to be a shootout, the district attorney Alfonso Sanchez decided to put all his resources and call the chief of police, Joe Black, and called all the state militia, state police, block all the roads and start arresting everybody on the grounds of unlawful assembly. Naturally, the people were too strong, too brave to swallow such a stupid accusation and grounds for arrest. They were enraged, they were angry, and in this state of anger, the following day after the mass arrest, they decided to arrest themselves, arrest the district attorney. They were furnished with a warrant of arrest, official documents signed by the alcalde, the mayor of San Joaquin, the deputies and the volunteers who went to Tierra Maria, the next town, to arrest Alfonso Sanchez. It was a plain citizen's arrest. It was turned out into a shootout because of the state police. And that day, there were a hearing was being held for the Alianza leaders that were being tried. And, of course, the following was published throughout the nation and the world that there was a revolution going on in Tierra Maria. Governor David Cargo, whose wife is a member of the Alianza, was in Michigan with Governor Romney, George Romney. Immediately he was called and took his special army jet to fly back to New Mexico. In the meantime, Mr. Francis, lieutenant governor, summoned the National Guard, state police, 150 mounted police, and they brought in three battle tanks and helicopters, airplanes, and so on. And the whole state was turned into a state of confusion. And even the Air Force in Albuquerque, Kirtland Air Force, Sandia Air Force, all the personnel were pulled out of the air base into the city of Albuquerque because they have been threatened to telephones that they were going to be bombed. Even the state penitentiary was triplicated their guards, and the whole state was in a state of confusion.
This all started because a conference, a meeting was going to be held?
Yes, in Coyote, New Mexico, right. Yes, they blocked, they sabotaged our meeting, and naturally the people, well-educated, they refused to allow a stupid man temper and fool around with our rights, our constitutional rights. See, in New Mexico, the people have been educated through the radio. We have a daily radio program, daily. We have been teaching our people the rights that have been frozen and sabotaged by the federal government, the rights that were practiced by these people for 300 years, and rights that have been barred out of school. See, the Spanish language, traditions and culture, and certain perpetual rights that we hold have been frozen completely.
And we're not... all of these rights, I want to get this clear, the original treaty of Guadalupe did reserve to your people these Pueblo lands and certain rights.
Yes, yes, sir. Yes.
And these rights have gradually been removed? Is that
yes, frozen. The government has never legally dissolved any right or any Pueblo whatsoever.
What was included in those rights? The right to your own schools and
language? Well, the culture, cultural rights, which includes the language, property rights, which includes the mode of, or the way of living that is concerning the property. See, we held no property individually, but a little home and a little garden. We could not hold over 150 square yards for ourselves. It was the Pueblo, the village, that held all the land in trust for the villagers. So naturally, the government comes and respects the Indian Pueblos, but the Spanish Pueblos, he freezes them, confiscates the land, takes it, converts it into public land or a U.S. forest land under the Department of Agriculture and the Department of the Interior. So naturally, that was an outright theft. We therefore accuse the federal government.
Well, did this take place gradually, or was it done sort of?
Yes, gradually. To start with, the public has not been told that after the treaty was signed, our government took full responsibility as our government to protect our lives and our property. Our property's patents, original patents and titles, were in Guadalajara, Jalisco. That was the Royal Audiencia who kept the original patents of the Pueblos and property rights. Well, in the year 1858, 10 years after the signing of the treaty, those documents were burned mysteriously in Guadalajara, Jalisco, before the United States took the courtesy, according to his obligation, to ask Mexico for a copy of those titles. Then in the year 1870, William A. Pyle, governor of the territory of New Mexico, with the help of the territory attorney general, who was Thomas Beck Catron, the king leader and the king of New Mexico for 50 years, the criminal shrewd person who masterminded the whole plan, took William Pyle and Thomas Beck Catron, kicked out of the archives of Santa Fe the documents that had been kept there for 300 years. They were kicked out in the street, according to Twitchell, historian Twitchell, and Bancroft. And according to newspaper film of that date, where in the editorial, William Pyle is called a pighead for kicking the Spanish archives out into the streets. I like to state that during these years, there was no judicial protection for the land grant titles, for the pueblos, for our property. There was no protection from 1848 to 1891. There was no judicial or tribunal hearings for the adjudication of these titles. It was in the year 1891 when Frank Springer, a friend of Tomás Beck Catron and a member of the Santa Fe Ring, asked Congress to establish a political court to adjudicate the titles. It was from 1891 to 1904 that the titles were adjudicated by a tribunal of five judges who were all veterans of the Civil War and veterans of the Confederacy, of the South, who hated the Spanish Americans and the Mexicans. And naturally, there was no documents when this court was established. It was a conspiracy, a criminal conspiracy by the federal government against my people. And now...
Now, wait a minute. What did the court, what decisions did they reach?
What decisions could we expect after they destroy all the documents?
But they did go
on record as
confiscating these lands?
No, they went on record as disapproving 33.5 million acres of the 35 million acres that we were claiming in New Mexico. Therefore, they just approved 1.5 million acres.
They left 1.5 million acres in the control of the pueblos.
Of the pueblos, right. And now that we have that the documents were discovered in 1960, Kenneth Sanders, a friend of the Santa Fe Ring, comes to New Mexico to sell the documents for $50,000. The sheriff of Santa Fe County confiscates the document, arrests the person, and the whole matter goes into court for 7 long years. It was this year, last year in December of 1967, that the U.S. District Court of St. Louis, Missouri, decided in favor of Mr. Kenneth Sanders. The defender, the attorney for Kenneth Sanders, the thief, was Thomas Beck Catron III. As you can see how the Catrons have been guarding very well their chin, their organized crime with the help of the federal government. And as you can see, then in 1862, May the 20th, 1862, the Homestead Act came about. And if you read the Homestead Act, it reads, and I quote, "No homesteads shall be issued within boundaries of land grants." For your information, thousands of homesteads were given to people within the boundaries of land grants. Now, this was during the 60s and the 70s, before the courts were, the land grants were adjudicated by the Court of Private Land Claims, which was later in 1881 to 1894. Why did the government violate its own act of Congress to throw the people into confusion, hatred, and fight among themselves? Because some naturally wanted their piece of 160 acres all to themselves with a title. Other heirs or members of the villages, they wanted their own way to let the pueblo administrate the common communal lands. So naturally there were two factions, two sides, they start fighting. In comes the federal government and adjudicates and takes over the land. So naturally the government thought that he had it made, see, but as the police of our days teaches the black and the brown that crime does not pay. Well, our federal government, the greatest giant ever built by taxpayers, is discovering that crime does not pay. Even his own crime against the Spanish American people is not paying. Now he's all surprised. He don't know what to do. And now he's discovering that time and his own crimes are catching up with our federal government.
El Corrido del Tigre Norteño by Roberto Martinez.
Ese tigre norteño del güerito fue el azote. Le dio combate al gobierno por todas partes del norte. En prisión para ver si se callaba, para ver si nuestra raza de su nombre se olvidaba. Pero se equivocaron y se dieron un quemón, porque el tigre norteño no les dio satisfacción. Nuestra raza con la que el tigre hablaba, pero desgraciadamente el gobierno no escuchaba. Hoy todos los mexicanos demandan en alta voz igualdad para nuestra raza, así como manda Dios. Todos deben realizar nuestra herencia cultural, sobre todo es preciso que la sepan respetar.
Dios me hizo mexicano y solamente Dios me quita esa dicha. ¡Sí, señor!
Y todo será posible si nos sabemos unir. Caminando como hermanos nadie nos podrá rendir. Que viva la raza mía, lo grito con emoción. Viva el tigre norteño y viva nuestra nación. Vuela, vuela palomita para cena aquel baraño. Estas son las mañanitas de ese tigre norteño.
This broadcasting was recorded at the University of California, Riverside. We want to thank everyone for their participation in this two-hour special of the legendary hero Reyes López Tijerina. We want to thank all other radio station affiliates, Pacifica Network, KERU 88.5 FM, and all others that participated in this collaboration.
The views expressed on Radio Aslan belong solely to the Radio Aslan staff and are not the opinions of the Regents of California nor KUCR staff or board.
We just finished broadcasting a tribute to the life and legacy of Reyes López Tijerina, who just passed away this past week. And so we wanted to recognize and honor that legacy on the radio program tonight. So we hope you enjoyed it. We hope that you were inspired. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why we played it, not only to pay tribute to this man that gave, you know, his life and his, you know, his corazón to the movement, to the causa, to his familia, to the community. And for us to play a small little tribute to him in his honor, in his name, for those that Enrique Murillo, I talked about earlier about why he brought him to his conference, was to introduce him to those that have never heard his name, that haven't read those history books, that doesn't have the honor of knowing him or taking a Chicano studies class, that we can talk about our heroes, that we can celebrate. But not only that, I think it's important to celebrate it, to recognize it, but also for a call of action. What are we going to do within our communities to honor that legacy? Because it's not just about remembering folks and what they did in history and just see it as a historical moment. It's what Navarro said earlier también about him being committed to scholarship and activism till, till this day and how it influenced them, but he continues that fight and continues to get involved in the community. So whether, you know, there's different types, whether it's the land grants or the issues of land or whatever it may be within yourselves and community, we would like to urge you as a call of action to pay tribute, to pay trail. Real homage is to do something in your community and to stand up for social justice and to make things right and to do it in honor of his name and all those that have come before us, that have laid that foundation, that have created this path for us to have fewer stumbles, for us to be able to, you know, to continue with greater ease, because those that have opened up those doors for us, but we know and we all know that it still needs to continue, that we're not quite there yet. We're not fully where we need to be in terms of having a just and fair system and you know, equality and what we fight for and live for. It's not where we're at. We've made a lot of strides because of people like him, because of all those that you heard tonight. They're the ones that have opened it, and many more. That what are we going to do to honor that legacy for ourselves, for our children and their grandchildren? So thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of this. Stay tuned to KUCR 88.3 FM, your Chicano alternative radio. Gracias for tuning in.